Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You know, there aren't too many comedians who could make this joke on The Tonight Show.
So we're in Northern Iraq. We're about to walk off the base, me and the two other comedians, and the sergeant looks at us and goes, hey, fellas, make sure to remove your name tags because I don't want you guys getting kidnapped. I was like, kidnapped? We can get kidnapped? I started to freak out, and then I remembered I'm in Kuwait in Iraq, and I look like everybody else there, you know? If anybody's going to get kidnapped, it's probably these two very white comedians I'm working with. Some terrorists were to hop out of a van like, hey, it's the kidnapping. Get in the van now. I'd be like, Habibi? Habibi, I'm going to tell you what I'm going to tell you. I'm going to tell you what I'm going to tell you. I'm going to I'm sorry, guys.
This is The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast, and that was stand-up comedian Mo Ammer talking about his very unique experience telling jokes for troops in Iraq as a Palestinian refugee from Houston, Texas. You might recognize Mo from his hilarious supporting role on Rami Youssef's Hulu show Rami. But he also just dropped an excellent new stand-up special called Mohammed in Texas, his second hour for Netflix. And I am thrilled to have him on today's show to talk about how he went from touring the world in the early 2000s with his Allah Made Me Funny comedy group to becoming one of the most impressive stand-ups on the scene right now. We also get into the very unique experience of performing in a cornfield at the height of the pandemic with his longtime mentor and friend, Dave Chappelle. I'm going to be honest, since Mo was calling in from his trailer on the set of his upcoming autobiographical Netflix series, the audio quality on this one leaves a little something to be desired, but it was still a really compelling talk, and I hope you enjoy it. So let's get to it. Here's me with Mo Ammer. All right, let's do this. How are you doing? You're doing stunts. You're filming your show. What's going on?
Yeah, I am. I'm filming my TV series currently. My script series.
Yeah, it's exciting. I'm looking forward to it. I've heard little bits about it, but I don't know too much about what it's going to be. What's you're almost done filming the whole first season, is that right?
Yeah, we're man, it's crazy. It's 40 days of filming. We're like 5 days away, I think, from being wrapped. It's pretty crazy.
Wow. Yeah.
Some B-roll stuff after, but pretty much done. That's easy stuff. But right now, yeah, we're in the home stretch, big home stretch. I'm literally covered in crap.
what kind of stunt were you doing?
I can't say much.
All right.
it'll really ruin it. Yeah. But it's just been a lot of fun. The show is about loosely based about my, not loosely, it's very much so based on my life. Loosely about the first special, basically like a refugee in America trying to work under the table while working through the bureaucracy and telling the story of someone that's been in America for 25 years and still waiting for his citizenship. And what does it take to do that while telling these great origin stories through flashbacks? You know, it's a lot of fun.
And it's funny.
No, it's horrible. It's very dramatic.
Very dramatic.
Really, honestly, bro, it's definitely very funny, of course, situationally. All the things I get myself into and the stories that I have for my life are pretty fun bringing them out in the series. But also, of course, there's a lot of tense moments. You know, every comedy has drama relief. Every drama has comedy relief. And that's how it works. But yeah, definitely a lot of heavy stuff in the series with the comedy, for sure. All grounded and real and tasteful. Yeah, it's awesome.
Well, I definitely want to talk about your new Netflix special, Muhammad in Texas, because I thought it was just fantastic. I really, really enjoyed it. So I noticed in your first Netflix special, you had Chappelle introducing you. And now in this one, you have The Rock introducing you. So I feel like you really are one-upping yourself each time.
It's so funny because not everyone knows that was Dave's voice, but the people that know. And he was actually there for that taping in 2018. We didn't use any of that footage. Maybe it'll be released at some point. But yeah, man, it was just one of those things. Honestly, man, I wasn't even intending to use it in the special at all. It was like something that I texted Dwayne about. I was like, yo, DJ, you know, it'd be so cool. It'd be such a great surprise for the audience. And I had zero intention or even asking him to put it in the actual special. It was his idea, you know, it was his idea. And I was like, yeah, hell yeah. It'd be so cool. Just to kind of give the audience at home a little peek into what happened that night, because obviously nobody in the audience knew, and it was such a great surprise. It was just fun. It was really fun to have it. And I definitely, I don't know, it's all downhill from here.
Yeah. Who are you going to get next?
Obama? I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's your only option. So you met The Rock doing Black Adam, is that right?
Correct.
Yeah. What was that experience like? You filmed, you're done with that, filming that movie?
Yeah. He's just a really jealous person because of how big a shape I am and how little effort I put into it. And how, the whole time he was just trying to catch up.
Yeah.
I dealt with it, bro, and I barely got out of it, but glad it's over. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
he's such a freaking amazing guy, man. He's exactly who you get. Like, what you see is what you get with him. He's so cool. He's so down to earth. Really funny. I wish he wasn't so perfect, but you know, he really is such a great guy, man. He's very polite on set when he's there. He's just like I said, man. He's really, really down to earth, dude. Like when I first met him, I was like, "Hey, man, what do I call you? Everybody's calling you. Some people call you Rock. Some people call you DJ. Some people call you Dwayne." He goes, "Daddy." Which is called Daddy.
So I feel like, you know, you used your first special, Vagabond, to really introduce yourself, you know, tell your story, you know, as you said, and that's also, you know, kind of what you're doing with this TV show. But with your second special, you know, it really branches out into so many other things. So what did you want to do? How did you approach, you know, this second special after you kind of have told more of your personal life story to take the second special and do something different with it? How did you think about that?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's something that happened really organically. First of all, it was just so annoying constantly explaining myself. So I appreciate you understanding what I was doing with the first special. It was just give people a lot of that backstory and just get that out of my system. And the really funny, entertaining stories. And this is just like, you know, real stand-up. It's just like, all not real, like not insinuating the other one was. It's just like really just talking about feeling free and saying whatever I want to say and at least like really going through my thought process and things that I truly reflect on and bring those forward. And that was happening pre-pandemic. Like I was already developing the hour. Didn't know exactly which direction I was going to go yet. But I was, you know, it is like you go on tour and start figuring it out and start taking out jokes that you did, you know, 10 years ago, this years ago, the new ones, fresh ones, just mixing it up, trying to figure out where it's going. And then I had a solid, you know, like 2 hours ready to play with pre-pandemic. And the pandemic happened, obviously changed everything. And I threw that all away. You know, I just like, all this material is now to the side. I need to move forward as if I have no material. And that's what I did. And I just started assessing the situation within the pandemic and how people were reacting to the media and how the information was being filtered down. Stock market and money, and is it real, is it not real? So it just started from there, and then I just started playing with it and molding it, bringing it back together, and it was just a beautiful thing that happened. I was filming Black Adam, I was writing my show. I was, you know, not much time to tour. Thankfully, I toured like a dog pre-pandemic, so I had that there, and I did all the shows with Dave in the cornfield with all those great comedians and artists that were there. And the encore was a complete accident, to be honest. The encore was something the crowd was just really going berserk. And I was like, oh, I'll just tell this story. because I have a Banksy, I have the two walls, I have the Mexican border wall. It's very subtle to some people. Some people is very, you know, right there in their face. But I just thought, hey, this could be a really good story about how the first time I went to Berlin, which is where my family's village is from. And so I just, yeah, so I just told that story. And then I didn't know I had the documentary footage. I was just like, didn't we film that? Where is that? I found an old external hard drive. It's like currently in the ICU still, as it was erected. And then my friend and documentarian had a backup. And like literally in the last second, she said, "Oh, these say Mo Nebles on these externals." I'm like, "Those have got to be it." So she sent them, and that exact story that I told on stage was there. So it was unintentional. Something that happened naturally. And the first special, if it was like a love letter to my mom and appreciation for my mom, and again, that one just happened, you know, as well. Second one was my love for Houston, my tip of the hat to Houston, and just kind of relating to the human race, really, all from all backgrounds and bringing us together. And then the encore is the encore, you know, that's just like a very personal piece, and it ended up being about my father, which is really special. Knowing his conscience, you know, so it was great, man. It was just really just a beautiful thing that happened. It all fell into place that way.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned those shows early in the pandemic in the cornfields with Chappelle and all those comedians, and you know, I was following that along on Instagram, kind of very jealous of what was going on there. And I would love to hear more about what that experience was like. I know it's in this movie that's going to come out hopefully somewhere.
Hopefully,
yeah. But that must have been sort of some of your first times performing during the pandemic. Was at those shows?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I had, not like most comedians where they had like over a year plus not performing. It was 3.5 months, but that was enough. It was so, because again, I was writing my TV series and I was just going from my bedroom to office, like going crazy, right? No, just fucking losing my mind, if I'm being honest. Just doing this repetition and 10 hours a day on Zoom, and, you know, just nightmare. You know, the situation, the world is just literally on fire. The George Floyd civil uprising, like civil unrest, it's just crazy. So having that creative outlet was like necessary, was needed. And I didn't realize how bad I was programmed. Also watching the news every day, doing that. Oh, what's happening? Where is it? This invisible thing that's going to kill us all. Like, so scary. To feel that way. And then when I got to Ohio, I was just on the wall constantly. I'm like, you know, I was just so freaked out on other people. And that's when I was just like, okay, I have no material. I'm just going to go up there. I'm not going to go up there and be like, hey guys, you know, we travel. You know, like I was just going, hey man, be a schizophrenic on stage right now. Like, just be you. And just throwed out. And like, I kept it all the way up until the special tape. Froze out. I looked a mess. I was scared from anybody getting close to me. And I'm just like, let's see what happens. Just ramble. And I would literally go like 100 miles an hour. That bit about the stock market was like 30 minutes within a 10-minute joint. Like, I was just putting everything down.
Because the stock market is a direct reflection of American hearts everywhere. If the arrow's going down, that means hearts and souls of Americans everywhere is also going down. But look, it's working. It's going up. Americans are happy again. It's going up. It's skyrocketing. Wait. How the is it skyrocketing? We're all at home. How is this thing going? I thought it was all based off of revenue streams and quarterly earnings, and nobody's working. I get Amazon. Everybody's at home ordering. This shit should be skyrocketing. Well, you, Jeff Bezos, and thank you, Jeff Bezos, all at the same time. Like, but how is it still going up, bro? I thought this was all based off of money coming in. Everybody's at home. Look, man, shut the up, okay? Just look at the arrow. God, can't you just shut your mouth and just be happy that the arrow's going up? No, I can't, bro. We need money. Look, here's $1,200. Hush money. Shut the up.
I remember Letterman going crazy for it when he came out. He was just like, Mo, oh my God, Mo. what was that? That was amazing. And I just like, my life is done. You know, like I made Letterman love me. Like that's all I care about.
You know? Yeah. So you were there. I mean, you were there like most of the time that he was doing it, right? The whole time. And then people would kind of come and go. So who were some of the other people that really kind of blew you away that came through there during that time?
Man, Bill Burr really blew me away, man. He's so damn funny. So damn funny, man. He's just so good. God, he's so good. Just love him. Just seeing him with his kids, and his wife. It just, you always get this like angry Burr almost on stage. Not every time, but you know, it's just Burr. It's classic Burr. And just seeing him just with his kid, like with his daughter, just she's eating out of, you know, she has him eating out of his hand. It was really cool to see. You know, not really the stand-up. Of course, the stand-up is great, but just seeing him and his with his family and seeing this really sweet, you know, family guy there. That was cool. Of course, you know, Kevin Hart came in and blew everybody away. He's so funny. It was funny over FaceTime. He was busting Chris Rock's balls over FaceTime when he was there, like literally doing impersonation and just killing over FaceTime. And then he popped in for like an hour, and then Trevor Noah and Letterman being there was like so classic. And Jon Stewart and just so many heroes like came in. And John I knew from before, from touring together with him and Dave. So, but just meeting Letterman was just this thing, because I was going to do Letterman before he retired. He retired, and I did Colbert, which is obviously still the late show. And it's amazing. It's not a but, and you know, I grew up with Letterman.
It would have been a special thing to go on Letterman. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like I wrote a letter to him when I was 11 or something. Like I want to do stand up on your show. You know what I mean? Like it's just that kind of thing. And then I ended up, you know, meeting him because he was interviewing Dave in the cornfield there for my next. And so that's why he came out. And once I knew he was in the audience to the left, I didn't give a shit about anybody else. I was performing, you know, I was performing for Letterman 100%. You know, I didn't care less about anything else. But that was the biggest highlights for me.
And he actually got up and did some stand-up?
He did. He went up and did like, you know, 10, 15 minutes. It was brief. And then he and the two Daves were on stage and they were riffing together. And he just kept being so complimentary of me on stage. And I teared up, man. It was just like one of the best moments of my life. You know, and that's because Dave, you know, Chappelle really did that, man. He really like gave everyone an opportunity to, not only did he put like money in people's pockets in Yellow Springs, it was their biggest economic earning ever, which is in a pandemic. It is safely, he literally like wrote the book on what it's like to be in a bubble. And it was a learning experience, of course, but he allowed us to do that. He and his wife, Elaine, are such special people, and the family there, you know, that's they're like family. You know, they're just such kind people and generous, fed everybody. He was testing the town. Not even us, not on his own dime. Anybody that wanted to get tested and come through, he would do that. It was just such a unique, like, it's never going to happen again. You know what I'm saying? Like, not our life, I don't think, God forbid, you know? But it was just one of those moments that you literally saw the thing being navigated while also having an outlet. And I was just busy all the time. I was constantly writing, and I would just perform, and I would leave. It's like 90% of the time, that's what I was doing. So it was just really hard to do anything else, but just having an opportunity just to do stand up and then have a creative outlet was priceless.
Yeah. And then, so there's this documentary, which, you know, I haven't gotten to see yet. And I think, you know, it's screened a few places, but it seems like it's not getting the release that maybe everybody would have wanted. And I don't know if that's stems from all the controversy around Chappelle. How do you feel about that? Do you think that it is sort of a cancel culture thing that is preventing the documentary from being seen?
Well, he's doing screenings all over the country. A, B, I talk about it in my special, so it's great. I talk about how I got COVID from it. It's been great, and I think it's been like a massive protector for me, honestly. It's in the whole situation. I got a funny, you know, just classic comedian shit. Like, I don't know about that, but I got some hilarious stories out of it, so.
I go to Ohio And it was an amazing run of shows, like almost 4 months of doing these shows. And we almost made it, but we had an outbreak, so we had to stop it. And he made it into a documentary film. It's an incredible documentary film. I saw it at Radio City Music Hall. It was the first time that I got to see it. And then I watched it, I was like, wait, the end of the movie makes it look like I ruined the whole fucking party. I got COVID and the whole thing had to shut down because I was being a bitch. I was like, wait, hold on a second. I walked up to Dave, I'm like, Dave, the way you edited this, you made it look that Muhammad was the villain in the whole situation. That's not the truth, bro. I didn't do that. He's like, oh, man, nobody's going to think this. And right after he walks away, Bradley Cooper walks up. He's like, man, it's really fucked up how you just ruined the party in Ohio. I was like, it wasn't me. An award-winning filmmaker saying that this is what it looks like. Oh, no.
And I'm sure the movie's going to be come out at some point. I'm sure it is. I mean, it's being shown all over the country in, like, stadiums, arenas. It's insane.
Coming up, Mo talks about how Dave Chappelle became his comedy mentor in the first place. And later, he tells the real story behind his fateful run-in with Eric Trump, and why he hates that it's the only thing so many people know about him.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're enjoying this episode and want to hear more, please make sure you are following The Last Laugh wherever you get your podcasts. We have had so many incredible stand-up comedians on the show this year, including Nate Bargatze, Nikki Glaser, Roy Wood Jr., Nicole Byer, Dane Cook, and more. By subscribing to The Last Laugh, you can listen to those episodes and everything else from our free archive, and you'll be the first to hear new episodes when they drop every Tuesday. And while you're at it, please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Let us know how much you love the show and who you want to hear next. Now, back to Mo Ammer. You know, I know that, you know, you've talked a lot about him being a big mentor of yours in comedy, you know, in general over the years. How did you actually first connect with Chappelle when you were earlier on in your career?
Well, my biggest mentor, which I should get a huge shout out, is Danny Martinez. Martinez owned the Comedy Showcase in Houston for 30 years. And he mentored people like Ralphie May, who was 18 years old, but nobody would give Ralphie May a shot. Mentored T'Shawn Channon, who went on to write for SNL for 10 years. He mentored Shayla Rivera, who just had her HBO special. Man, there's so many people. And he took me under his wing when I was 17 years old, thought I was going to be his last student. And he taught me everything there is about stand-up comedy, like the art form, the technique, being a road dog earning your wings, how fast he foresaw my entire career. He said that, he told me this when I was 17. He goes, you're going to do great. You're going to be on television. You're going to be touring the world. You're going to be doing this. You're going to be doing that. I see you as a TV star. You're going to have your own show. You're going to have a sitcom series based around your life. He literally told me all this when I was 17 years old. And he said, so you're going to be a great comedian, all that. Because I've seen many come through. Because I used to book Bill Hicks. I used to book this. I used to Sam Kinison, this and that. He goes, let me tell you something. You've got it. It's going to take you 20 years.
He's like an oracle.
He is. No, he is that guy. He was telling me stories about Jeanne Garofalo, how, you know, he saw her because she's going to pop, and everybody thought he was fucking crazy. She was reading from a notebook. And she was alt comedian before alts even existed, right? And he's like, you're going to be huge. He walked up and he's like, you're going to be so famous. And he's right. And so he told me it take 20 years for you to have this overnight success. And if you're on board with that, then great. If not, don't waste my time. I looked at him. I said, great, let's do it.
So what did he teach you? What did you know?
Bro, literally everything. Performance from the moment you walk on stage, how to stay alert, like with the audience, assessing them before you even go on. Mic technique, where you hold the mic when you move it, go. Pacing, eye connectivity, you know, with the audience. Just bring them in, no matter how big the audience is, how low. He was teaching me about arenas before I even started working them, like how to work them, the pacing of your bits. Everything goes there. When I started doing Chappelle stuff, I was just like murdering. It was just absolute murdering. It all has to do with like what he ingrained in me. Like all the bad habits were gone. He's that guy. So he taught me everything there is to know about how to be a stand-up comedian and truly be tried and true. Like really, really be a stand-up and perform anywhere, anytime. Microphone, no microphone. Taught me all of it. Everything. It was incredible. Incredible. And the comedians that were smart would listen, and they did fucking great. You know, look at Ralph. You know, he did phenomenal. You know, essentially the first winner of Last Comic Standing, to be honest. And just like T-Shawn himself. Like guys that really listened to him went on, and other comedians in general, they did very well in staying up if they stuck with it. And so that's where I was. I would look around, I'm like, these guys are dumb. They're trying to fight over a spot at some supposedly A club, and they're just like not getting spots, not going on the road because they just want to hang out and not really understanding what it takes to be a stand-up. I was just like, you guys are dumb, fine, I'm going to do this. You know, I see it. So he was that guy. And Dave, for me, is like, you know, if Danny gave me the mentorship on how to get here, is like, Dave, what he taught me is like, he's a true master of the art form. Like how to piece things together, but also how to like mentally prepare for this altitude, you know? So that's what that is. And it's like, he's really one of the most brilliant minds that I've ever met. And I know a lot of really amazing people in my life. I'm fortunate to have that. He's just one of those incredible people. That he did that himself. You know, we just started touring together. It just happened. I met him in 2007. We were doing the All American Funny Tour. He popped into the show, did an hour. His mom came, his brother came, his niece came, his sister came, and we all had dinner that night. This is in 2007. It was just so surreal. He surprised our audience, did an hour clean. Like, what? Nobody asked him to do anything, you know? That, and it was just incredible to witness that. And then from there, you know, he was doing shows, I think, in 2011 or 12 in Oakland. And me and Azhar Osman, another great comedian, toured the weather world, doing the world, doing a little bit funny. He found out Dave was in Oakland, so we just popped in Oakland. And then next thing you know, he was like, I want to open tomorrow. I was like, yeah. I want to open the next day? Yeah. You want to open the next day? Yeah. Then 2,000 shows later, 9 years later, I was. Yeah.
It's wild, yeah.
And it was always like that. You want to come tomorrow? I've never been booked in advance with Dave, ever.
It's always like, a last minute thing.
It was like presumed. I was like, that's nice to know.
What was it like, you know, in those first few, you know, shows or first times opening for him and going up, you know, in front of probably, I imagine that was some of the biggest crowds you had gone up in front of at that point, right? No?
When we did All I'm Even Funny, we were just, that's why Dave was so impressed what we did. We toured the world doing stand-up at different, I mean, like literally before it was like a thing. We did the, I've already done the, I did Royal Albert Hall in 2007 and 8 with a band out of Denmark called Outlandish. This organization heard about me, they booked me for that. That's a 5,500 seater that we did. I did a couple of times. It's probably still the most gorgeous venue I've ever worked. And I told Dave about it. He ended up working it. We ended up doing it together in 2018 for his first time. He was like, I did it. I put it in his head. I was like, this is the best venue I've ever worked, bro. I promise. It's amazing. It's breathtaking. It's charming. It's intimate, yet big. And we ended up doing it. And I put it in his ear, you know, like to do that venue because I really wanted to do it with him and being him and Jon Stewart. So it was that, you know, it's just like we did those shows. We did Durban, South Africa, 4,000 seats. Cape Town, South Africa, we did 1,500 seats. You know, we were doing big venues already. Obviously, Dave has like stepped it up, and it's Dave, you know, like he was still on his, in the beginning, it was just his early on in his quote-unquote comeback. And then, of course, he just started doing all these theaters, and it was so much fun doing them in repetition that often. To be able to do that, it was incredible, like 9 shows at the Tabernacle in Atlanta. You could have done a whole month. They said 2 shows a night, you know, forever. And then he just, like, does that at those venues. And then we started doing, like, amphitheaters, and that's, of course, the biggest venue I've ever worked. Just casually, hey, you want to come to Shoreline Amphitheater? Nas and Lauryn Hill asked the show, can you come do it with me? And I was like, yes, of course. I definitely fucking be that show. You know, like shit like that. And Radio City Music Hall, working with like Chance and Hannibal, which is my boy, I love him, and John, and Lauryn Hill again. It's just those kind of experiences, obviously, are very different. But I chomp at the bits of those, you know, like, you're a pro. Hell no. I can't wait to get it. Give it to me. I feel different, you know? 23 years professionally, it's like, come on, it's butter. Let's go.
Yeah, I know. It's wild how long you've been doing it. And it was interesting to, you know, when I was reading about you that you actually, you know, started pretty shortly before 9/11. And I'm curious, you know, what was it like to, you know, to start before that? And then how did things change for you, you know, after 9/11?
Yeah, the first time I did stand-up was in 95.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
14 in my class. I kept doing it in my high school because it started spreading. My teachers would get me to do stand-up. I would ask them, and they would let me do stand-up. And then I walked into the comic clubs when I was 17. But yeah, it was obviously a completely different landscape, and it changed things, and it really made it so much more important to be part of the culture and influence culture. And specifically with my, you know, geographical location being in the South and touring the South, it was wildly different and subjected to a lot of not only criticism, but, you know, prejudice and racism. And I didn't let that bother me. I just said to myself, like, this is what it's going to take, and this is what's going to truly mold you to who you are in the future. And having those experiences are invaluable and historical in nature. So I knew that was happening, even though I was broke as fuck. And I knew that it was important to stay steadfast and move forward and be an influence in culture. And I was always so ahead of it that I just was waiting for Hollywood to catch up. And thankfully it did.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like you really started to actually blow up during the Trump years, which is, I guess, ironic maybe in some ways. But, you know, you had that story about your run-in with Eric Trump, which went viral and drew a lot of attention to you. You know, also, you know, coming out in being so in much. Rami. You what?
I hated that so much. When Dave saw that, he goes, bro, fame is chasing me. I was like, I don't want him to chase me like that.
That's not how you wanted to get fame, is that what you mean?
No, you want it to be on the merit of your, you know, your art, the way you contribute.
You were not thrilled with the way that drew attention to you. So what was that experience like of all of a sudden, you know, you got a lot of incoming you know, people wanting to talk to you about that? Or,
well, I didn't think how big of a deal it was, because his dad just had gotten elected and I landed in Scotland to hundreds of emails from every publication you could ever imagine, texts from everyone. And just as my friend, I was like, why is this such a big deal? It's so dumb. Like, we just talked for a little bit. He goes, bro, no one has talked to the Trump family. Shut it down completely. You're literally the only one on earth that has addressed this and talked to him publicly.
Yeah, and there was some sort of like catharsis for people, the idea that you were confronting him, or, you know, sort of.
But it was both. The Trump side used me like, see, look at us. You know what I mean?
They were using you to say, like, that they were cool with Muslims, or is that what they were trying to say?
Yeah, my son, you know, took a trip all the way to fucking, oh, great, I'm glad you can muster that in first class. Like, you know, that was one thing. But immediately I realized how big it was. And I was on tour, you know, doing, you know, a regular tour throughout actually it was like a really rigorous tour throughout England and Scotland. However, I knew it was like, hey, man, you got to go make this funny immediately.
You wanted to kind of take control of the narrative in some ways?
Take control of the narrative, but more importantly to me is that, you know, I'm a real fucking stand-up. You know, like, this is not some gimmick. You know, I'm not a gimmick. I'm the real deal. Like, I'm gonna go work this out immediately. So I would do my set, like the tour set, and I can't, because people are expecting a show. Of course, we're doing theaters throughout England and Scotland. You can't just workshop bits that much. I would have a line or two, so I would leave the show, and the local comedians in England, wherever we were in one city, they would set up, they would tell me, oh, this open mic going on tonight, great. And I would just run to that open mic. And I would start working out the bit. And I realized how big it was when I was in Midlands, nowhere, England. And I would go up at an open mic, and there was people in the audience that go, hey, that's the guy.
that's the guy, the Eric Trump guy.
Shit, this is everywhere. Yeah. So it's just like, it's really important. So when I came back to New York, already had the bit like primed and started doing it, and then that's when I did Colbert right after that.
Sure. Yeah, that was sort of like your opening bit on Colbert. Was that sort of a no-brainer to bring that bit to Colbert at that point?
Yeah, just let it go. Release her.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, it's like you don't want to be known for the photo and all that, but then you also sort of capitalize on the experience.
As long as you make it funny. No, it's like, it's gotta make it funny. That's all that matters. Make it funny. That's all that matters. Nothing else matters.
I recently took a flight with Eric Trump. Not on purpose. It just happened. I didn't know he was going to be in the plane. Might have showed up in your social media feeds. But I do know one thing. The lady who upgraded me into that seat was certainly a Clinton supporter. 100%. 100%. She was like, oh, Eric Trump is on my flight? Is that what you're telling me? Oh, there's an empty seat next to Eric, is there, huh? Let me take a look at this upgrade list, see who's waiting patiently to be upgraded. Oh, Mohammed Mustafa Emma, upgrade! Yeah, hey, what's the heck?
Let's do our final segment that we do on the show, which is called The First Laugh. So I want to just run through a little speed round of some firsts in your career. So do you remember the first piece of comedy that made you laugh really hard as a kid?
Oh man, I do. It was the first special I saw on television. It was Dana Carvey's special, and had the OJ stuff and the piano. That was just so fun.
Chopping broccoli.
Dana Carvey's brilliant. Chopping broccoli. That's it. Yeah.
Do you remember the first joke that you told on stage? Maybe it was even in high school that really worked. That you felt like you had found a great joke.
I don't know if I found it, but it was good. The first thing I did in my English class was a Shakespearean monologue that I just made really, really funny in a British accent and started playing off when I was 14. And then when I did the actual bit, I did a delivery driver that was a pizza delivery guy that was beaten to death by a guy that he was delivering pizza to, that he just beat the hell out of him. It was really physical. But then when I first, his standard was just to play my name and how Texans say my name, and it was Mohammed, and how they would add ham in the middle of it. It's not, I'm not very proud of this joke. I'm also 16 years old, so it's okay. Yeah, it was always really, it was so filthy. The other one was really filthy.
Do you have a quick story about one of your worst bombs that you've ever had? Really a show that didn't go well?
Oh, those are easy. You remember those easily. Laughs are dime a dozen. Those stay with you forever, my friend.
what's the most memorable one?
I don't want to say, but
how come?
So I was doing all these Penn State schools, booking like 27 Penn State schools. I'm sorry, 23 Penn State schools. I think there's only 23. They're all of them. Some of them commuter campuses. So you got to do like these nooner shows. So I'm doing this noon show. It's a big campus. I was like, that's a big show. I'm going to kill this. It's going to be so much fun. I'll get them organized. Sure enough, 5 minutes in, they're organized, just killing. Like, that's awesome. It's a breeze. What a great show this turned out to be. And then there was a class of, trying to figure out the right wording here. There was like students they brought in middle of my set who are handicapped, mentally handicapped. And there's one, they're there. The kid, he knew what he was doing. He walked in and just started booing me, just right out the gate. Right? He just goes, boo, like this. And then he starts clapping, laughing at himself. And I swear to God, you could hear a pin drop, okay? You could hear a pin drop.
Yeah.
And I looked
what are you supposed
at him,
to do then?
I just was just smile on my face, with a smile on my face. I go, who brought this guy? Right. And I just thought it was really funny. And that moment. And the kids were, they're all kids. They're like 18, 19, super immature. Don't know how to handle this. So I was like, we'll just be quiet. Listen, every time I started to talk, he would boo me.
God.
And then laugh at himself booing me. He's having a great time booing me. Like, he came, he knew he was coming to a live show. He was like, I'm going to boo him. That's what I'm going to do. Nobody stopped him. Nobody tried to. It was just complete, utter death the next 40-plus minutes. I did 52 minutes. That was a miracle. It was like 48 minutes of just getting slaughtered. And I remember laughing in the middle of my set, just like dying laughing. Nobody knew I was laughing. But I had an out-of-body experience where I saw myself eating it on stage. And that's the funniest thing you could ever witness as a comedian, is somebody else eating it. So I was crying. I was laughing so much at myself at the situation. Crying. And then
That's a good attitude to have.
Oh, what am I supposed to do? I'm dead. Bro, I'm dead in the water. And I got off stage, and I hated my life. And it was a neuter show, so I had another show at 7 p.m. Couldn't wait to get to that show. The balls on the guy who booked me. He called my agent and goes, you know, he only did 52 minutes. It's contraction. I'll be in an hour. I was like, I was booed by a disabled person for 50 minutes. Like, it's a miracle I did that long. Like, how, what am I supposed to do, man? There's only so much torture one person can take. So, that's one of the worst things in my life, for sure.
I do want to just quickly mention Rami, which I'm such a big fan of your work on that show, and I think it's such a great show.
Oh, my God. She's already sending you selfies?
Yeah.
It's a blowjob for sure, bro.
No, dude, it's not about that, man. It's so much more. Like, I haven't connected with someone like this for a really long time.
Yeah, okay. You sent her a dick pic, right?
Dude, no, I just met her yesterday. That's crazy.
Oh, I mean, everybody likes a teaser. That's why movies have trailers. That's why they have pictures of food on menus. It's all about management of expectation.
No, dude, dick pics are creepy.
You know what's creepy? To pull down your pants and this random dick pops out? Are you kidding me? Dicks are weird, bro. I feel bad for women. You gotta give her a chance to say no from afar. All right? It's all about consent.
And so I'm wondering if there's a memory or something that stands out from your experience working on that show that you can share, something from the set.
It's all really fun, man. Those are all special moments we have when we all work together. I would definitely say, like, Mahershala being on set, and my long-term friend Amir Suleiman, who's an amazing poet and writer, probably the greatest poet of our generation. There, like, it was a full circle moment for me. I've been friends with Amir Suleiman since like 2007-8, maybe before. And just seeing both of us there together with Mahershala, and I introduced him to Rami. And also, so he ended up being on the show, and he had a relationship with Mahershala before that. So that was really, really an amazing full circle moment.
Very last thing is, I like to give comedians a chance to shout out other comics that are really making them laugh right now. So is there anyone that you want to shout out who you think is really funny and someone who's making you laugh these days?
Yeah, I mean, Chris DiStefano is just a nightmare of a human.
Yeah.
He's just a nightmare of a person, and like in a good way, in the best way possible. And he's so free, and he's so funny, he's so energetic. There's so many, man. But he's somebody who really sticks out. Just that Kirsten is a murderer. I feel like she needs her time.
Oh, yeah. She's been on this show. She's great.
She is a nightmare. She's so funny. And so is Chris. And there's just a lot of good, funny comics, man, that are popping out of New York. But he's definitely one of my favorites.
Cool, man. Well, thank you so much for doing this, and good luck with the rest of your shoot.
Thank you, brother. Nimesh Patel, very funny as well. All right, brother. I love, man.
Peace,
thank
man.
You so much for having me, my bro.
All right. Bye.
Here, man.
All right. Thank you so much to Mo Ammer for joining me on today's show. His newest special, Muhammad in Texas, is streaming now on Netflix. You can also see him in both seasons of Rami on Hulu, and we will be looking out for his new Netflix series, hopefully coming sometime next year. If you want to support The Last Laugh, please help us out by leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. We want as many people to hear this show as possible, and you can help by spreading the word and sharing it with your friends. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram, where you can see photos and videos from all of our episodes and see who is coming up next week on the show. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Jesse Cannon. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.